Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Deloitte Fireside Chat, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I am Dr. Mark Peacher, Professor of Accountancy at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and moderator for today's program. The Deloitte Fireside Chat series is made possible through a partnership between Deloitte LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Deloitte is the brand name under which tens of thousands of dedicated professionals and independent firms throughout the world collaborate to provide audit, consulting, financial advisory, risk management, and tax services to selected clients. Through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, the SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. The virtual museum and archive is the premier, trusted, and permanent online resource of financial regulatory history and now welcomes more than 5,000 visitors a day. Both the museum and the society are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities Exchange Commission and receive no funding from the public sector. The society is grateful for the generous and sustained support of Deloitte LLP in helping make the Deloitte Fireside Chats possible. Today's broadcast is the 10th in the series that began in 2009 to address current issues in financial regulation of interest to the accounting and auditing professions. All past broadcasts, ranging from preventing and detecting financial reporting fraud to the role of professional judgment, are available in the Deloitte Fireside Chat section under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive. I actually had the privilege of moderating past chats on the role of the auditor and the profession's look at the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and I'm happy to share that more than 17,000 visitors to the virtual museum and archive have accessed one or more of these chats during or since broadcast. I'm encouraging those joining with us today to check out the Deloitte Fireside Chat section at the conclusion of the broadcast. The series will be well worth your time. For today's 10th Deloitte Fireside Chat, we will be looking at financial reporting, examining the past and present models, and looking ahead to the future. Now, I'm joined today by J. Michael Cook and Joseph Yugazoglu. Mike is former chairman and CEO of Deloitte LLP and the former chairman and president of the Financial Accounting Foundation. He has been active on corporate boards and can share his thoughts on both his practitioner experiences and board experiences. Joe is National Managing Partner for Government, Regulatory, and Professional Matters for Deloitte LLP. He is former Senior Advisor and Professional Accounting Fellow in the SEC Office of the Chief Accountant. Joe is also a member of the SEC Historical Society's Board of Advisors. So let me begin by asking a question, maybe teeing off to Mike, about what do you see the differences between broadly financial reporting and financial reporting as it relates to the filing of statutory financial statement audits with an organization like the SEC?
Mark, they start with sort of the background of the regulatory financial reporting, which it's been with us for a long time. We've had the 10-K for almost 80 years, almost the length of time that we've had the SEC for some years. Kind of before my time, we had a 9K, which was a semi-annual filing, and then in about 1970, that was replaced by the 10Q. So we've had quarterly reporting for close to 50 years as well, and that has been pretty much the norm. The 8K has been there throughout the period. The timing of filing of 8Ks, the content of 8Ks has changed over time, and now we have a relatively timely, almost immediate filing of certain information when events take place that require 8K reporting. The 10Qs, as I say, have been with us for quite a long time. They have not changed dramatically from a regulatory standpoint during that period. There have been changes and updates, but not changed dramatically. And when you step back and think about how much has changed in just 10 years or 20 years, say nothing of 35 or 40 years, the speed of communication, the form of communication has changed very dramatically, and some would ask whether the regulatory requirements have kept pace with those changes. And people at the SEC are asking those questions of themselves and challenging it. For me, and my perspective here is principally as an audit committee chairman of large public companies, financial reporting today is based on financial statements, based on, to some extent, regulatory filings, but it is much more than that. Financial reporting is a continuous process, a continuous flow of information to investors for decision making. And few companies might even today be reporting more frequently than quarterly, but for most companies today, the crux of their public financial reporting is driven by the quarterly process. The earnings release, the communications that they have with analysts, the analyst phone calls, the releases that they put out. And those almost always take place, they always take place prior to the regulatory filings and sometimes quite a bit before the regulatory filings. So the driving force in my experience of late at least is that the earnings release process on a quarterly basis is the information that investors are getting and using to make investment decisions. Foundation of all of this is GAAP-based regulatory filings, but I kind of illustrate this in talking to folks about it by saying, let me illustrate by asking you to visualize a financial reporting train. And the engine of the train, in my experience, and I think many others would today, is the quarterly communication, the timely communication by management to investors. Audit committees are engaged in that part of the process through their oversight role, and auditors are, in my experience, generally associated with the quarterly information on a timely basis, but not always. Annual financial statements, the annual audit, perhaps sadly, but nonetheless, the annual financial statements and the annual audit, in my experience, are kind of in the caboose of the financial reporting train. It is becoming or approaching obsolescence as a vehicle to communicate with investors. It fulfills a function with respect to compliance. It fulfills a function with respect to stewardship. But people are really not using the annual financial statements, which will be issued next February or March, to make investment decisions in the marketplace today. They need timely information. There's a possibility that the annual audit, the annual financial statements, will disclose something that has not previously reached the marketplace and therefore might cause the market to move at the time that they are issued, but rarely is that the case. The important information that people are making decisions on are flowing to the marketplace much more on a timely basis. So it is a question first of timing. In the financial markets that we have today, with the volume of activity, with the decisions that are being made every day, how can even a quarterly report is of some question or challenge in terms of its effectiveness from a timeliness standpoint, but annual is just a period of time that just doesn't make sense for the investing public, other than to compartmentalize some things for annual assessment. The second issue around this, which is evolving and changing and expanding in my experience, is content of financial information. GAAP-based annual financial statements are usually not or often not adequate to meet the information needs of people to make investment decisions. Hence, you have a proliferation of non-GAAP information of various kinds, which is necessary for managements and companies to communicate with their shareholders the things the shareholders need to know to be able to judge the performance of the company and project from their assessment of that performance future cash flows, the things that financial information is supposed to achieve. You have different kinds of non-GAAP information. You have information which is derived from the GAAP financial statements but is adjusted in numerous ways to try to portray what people call core earnings as opposed to traditional net income and traditional earnings per share. And then you have many companies will have non-GAAP metrics to measure their performance, things like operating cash flow or EBITDA or free cash flow, things of that kind, which are more meaningful to investors to understand this company and how this company is performing than traditional net income and earnings per share. Also, add on to that, and this maybe to some people's mind outside the financial reporting scheme, but it's part of the overall process, is business performance information. Some is financial, a lot is not financial. And it is critical for this information to be communicated for people to understand, again, how the business is performing, not just the numbers, but customer information and market share information and other things of that type, which are essential to overall financial reporting. Okay, so I've got the financial reporting engine. I've got the quarterly process up there with the audit committee, hopefully up there with them, and the auditors dropping by at least regularly to ride in the engine. Question for the discussion today is, where are the regulators? Where are the regulatory processes? And I would suggest, for the most part, they're in the caboose, or they're close to it. The PCAOB, not entirely by their choice, but they have a legislative mandate from the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which relates to annual audits of annual financial statements of registrants. They don't have a mandate that pertains to timely reporting. They don't have a mandate that pertains to non-GAAP information. But the places where they are focusing their attention are part of what I would suggest is becoming increasingly less important to the investing community. The SEC pays attention to quarterly results. They pay attention to earnings releases and non-GAAP information, but in a very high-level, broad way through things such as Reg FD and Regulation G and 10b-5 and so on. But the principal focus of the SEC, in my experience, continues to be on the annual reporting process. They thoroughly review 10Ks, and my suggestion would be that that may be quite valuable in the overall scheme of things, but where are the review processes that relate to the 10Qs? Where are the review processes that relate to earnings releases and non-GAAP information? The things that are more important to investors are not part of that review process, or certainly not to the extent of the annual compliance-based financial reporting. FASB, as not a regulator per se, but a standard setter, for the most part is focused on the annual financial statements and the annual report. So I probably have them mostly in the caboose with others or close to it. But there are some signs, a recent movement perhaps to alter things in the presentation in the income statement that might say there is a sensitivity to GAAP not getting the job done in terms of being able to communicate to investors, but a need to perhaps report things differently within the income statement to separate out non-recurring or non-essential items from the core operations. And one of the advantages of that, of course, would bring it into the entire system where the audit and assurance processes would apply to that as well. My friends, the auditors, and I'll let Joe speak to this, where are they? I think in reality, in my experience, they're very often up in the engine. They're working on a continuous basis with the company, particularly large companies. They are involved in quarterly financial reporting. They are giving assurance to audit committees, not externally, but to audit committees, about the reliability of quarterly financial reporting. And I think that is where great value is being added, unfortunately, to the investor community, to the public. They're back in the caboose because nobody ever hears from them except for the one time a year, and I jokingly, and I'm smiling at Joe when I say this, jokingly say is a day close to Groundhog Day where the auditors emerge for one day, express their opinion on the financial statements, and return to their former location not to be heard from again for approximately another year. There's a lot more going on in the audit process. There's a lot more value being added than can be expressed in a once-a-year, one-day communication focused on an annual period of time. So I think there is value opportunity here for everybody, but that assurance that they provide needs to be timely. We could talk a little bit about the future. I don't have a very clear view of the future, but I think back, I couldn't have predicted how financial information would flow today, 5 or 10 years ago, to say nothing of 25 or 30 years ago, how rapid it is, the forms in which it comes. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit as we get into crystal balling the future.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of interesting changes there, changes driven, Joe, in part by timing and content, the proliferation of business metrics, and interesting discussion on regulators and how auditors are actually doing a lot of things behind the scenes from the perspective of investors. It's a little opaque to them, except I've never heard auditors compared to Groundhog. That's really good. But I want to switch over to Joe. And what are some of the fundamental underlying reasons for this potential realized drop in the relevance of the annual financial audited financial statements?
It's a great question, Mark. And first, let me say what a privilege it is to have Mike here with us and really a unique opportunity to sort of hear a firsthand perspective from an individual who has sort of had a front row seat to the evolution of the financial reporting system over the last half century. So this is a real treat. I'm not sure I would frame it in exactly the same way. You know, the assertion that the financial reporting process through regulatory means somehow is taking on less importance. I think what I'd say is that there's simply a shift here. It's not an either or, but it's a building upon. So the sort of regulatorily mandated periodic financial reporting system is still the foundation upon which everything else is built. And there is tremendous assurance and comfort that is provided to the investing community by virtue of the fact that those reports have integrity and that the auditor is in there, as Mike indicated, sort of within the financial reporting engine and providing levels of assurance on not just the financial statements, but the system of internal control for larger public companies at periodic intervals. But when you ask, well, then why isn't that enough? Why has there been such a sort of shift to a need to supplement that basic financial reporting with a much broader set of reporting, including press releases, key performance indicators, a dialogue around sort of business metrics with the analyst community? I think that shift really tracks the shift in the sort of value creation model within the broader economy. So if you go back to a time where sort of the economy was primarily driven through sort of bricks and mortar means, the basic financial reporting system tracked that value creation chain very nicely. You put up a plant, the financial statements reflect the amortization of that building, the creation of inventory, which then was sort of sold through, and you could see the revenue and the cost of sales come through. And then that periodic financial report did a very nice job of measuring up sort of whether the company was a net creator or destroyer of value. As the economy has moved to primarily in many sectors being intellectual property-based, intangibles taking on a much more prominent role, well, now you go to the balance sheet and the income statement, and they actually do a very poor job in some cases of reflecting that value creation cycle. So if you take an early stage company that's investing a lot of money in R&D, building up a very, very valuable technology, they may patent that and have succeeded beyond their wildest dreams and have the prospects for tremendous future cash flows. Yet if I freeze it at a point in time, I may look at the annual income statement and see losses because all of those R&D expenditures went through as expenses. I look at the balance sheet and I see zero because we have a historical cost-based model where I don't reflect the intellectual property that's come into existence on a fair value basis. And yet investors are sort of clamoring to buy that entity's securities, and rightfully so. And so naturally the marketplace has looked to supplemental measures of value over and above sort of tangible equity and gap-based earnings to form a more complete understanding of metrics that might be predictive of future cash flows. And so it's not at all surprising that that basic financial reporting, which still comprises the underlying integrity of the system, has to be supplemented with the other mechanisms that I think Mike very articulately laid out.
Yeah, absolutely. As our society shifts from this industrial era to an information-driven economy, one of the things that also comes into mind, and we can stay with you, Joe, or shift over to Mike, is just looking at technology a little bit more carefully. I know a very small part, arguably, of that is the availability of XBRL, but just the idea of being able to get more information to management, to auditors, and to investors through things like big data, is that going to change not only the way that stakeholders receive information and thereby even make statutory financial reporting even more so in the caboose, or will you see something happen in the standard setting venue that will change the content of quarterly or annual financial statements. One example would be, and this is not financial statement, but it is an example of how fast these things could manifest. Floyd Norris had an article in the New York Times explaining that banks, starting next summer, are going to need to calculate liquidity daily and presumably report this calculation to stakeholders. And this is in part to help overcome the risks of only sporadic financial reporting. So this is a technology question, and it's not probably going to just affect banks.
There's no question, Mark, that technology is enabling a revolution in information flow, and the financial reporting process will in no way be immune. I won't predict a timeline over which this occurs. You can't underestimate how difficult it is to move the super tanker that is the financial reporting system, with all of its sort of longstanding legacies in terms of the role of management, the auditor, the investment community, the regulators. But quite frankly, the relic of sort of receiving your mail and seeing a report every 3 months or every year is clearly going to be replaced with a much more real-time and dynamic system. And there's a number of elements to it. It's not just the timing. It will become much more immediate. It's also the manner of presentation. Right now, we use a flat file to communicate a lot of this. We haven't yet leveraged the ability of technology to enable sort of summarized reporting that then enables different users with different levels of information needs to sort of drill down and obtain successively greater levels of detail in a customized format based on their personal information needs. That is coming. As companies evolve their information systems, it will enable much more timely reporting of key metrics. Ultimately, auditors will be required, and we at Deloitte are putting significant investment dollars into new forms of technology to harness data analytics and big data and form insights in ways that are different from the traditional sampling-based assurance techniques, and in turn may allow us to provide more real-time assurance on the information that management is putting out to the investment community on a much more timely basis. So this is all happening very fast. Again, it won't all transform overnight, but I actually think in the next couple of years, you'll see some pretty significant movement towards a much more customizable, real-time system of reporting that's all foundationed upon sort of the use of big data and technology.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating. The content of what is being reported upon, not only in financial statements, but in these very important press releases, these Q&A sessions during conference calls, a lot of this is really related to complex financial statement estimates. This is a long way away from what you saw in, say, 1969 Wheat Report, where there was just a real reluctance, especially within a prospectus, to have any hint of a projection. Because of civil liability issues or because of the idea that this could be a trap for unsophisticated investors who might be prone to attach more significance to projections than they really deserve. But what you see now is that's kind of gone out the window. You see a lot of information coming out, not just in the financial statements, that is very estimate-based, and there's no thought about the degree to which can investors handle this? The market's demanding it. It's quite the reverse. Having said all of that, one thing that is providing a pause button in the regulatory space is that there is now an effort underway at the SEC. It's called the Disclosure Effectiveness Project, and it's going to be one of the first top-down look at the financial statements. In particular, the Division of Corporate Finance is reviewing the disclosure requirements in Reg SK and SX, which provides requirements for financial statements, and is considering ways to improve the disclosure regime for both the company and investors. So this is an unusual thing in regulatory history. Instead of a issue-by-issue emergence that the FASB has taken on, this is sort of step back and look almost from whole cloth. I wondered if you had any insight, either Mike or Joe, about what direction this may take us.
Joe? Sure, let me start. With respect to the SEC's review of disclosure effectiveness, you know, clearly they ought to be commended for recognizing that there's a need to modernize the regime for the benefit of investors. And this isn't about, you know, less disclosure. It's about more effective disclosure. I think what's interesting, though, is when you hear the SEC talk about this project, part of what they've come to conclude is that sort of their current rules aren't necessarily the impediment to making progress. There are a lot of enhancements that could be made by companies if only the marketplace would sort of leverage the opportunity here to disclose information in a much more meaningful and transparent way. There are some things that probably need to be tweaked in the rules, some required duplications that could go away. But the SEC has essentially extended an invite to the corporate community to essentially cease the practice of layering and simply putting more and more on top of what you already did last year and take a fresh look at whether the several hundred pages that have accumulated over time is really doing its job as an effective means of communication to the investing public. And one of my sort of favorite slogans is that the disclosure process shouldn't be a means of regulatory compliance. It ought to be a means of communication. And when you view it through that lens, what do investors need to know? You get a much higher quality product than what do the rules require me to disclose. I also want to sort of respond to sort of you articulated some thoughts around the fact that numbers are becoming much more estimates based, and that's partly feeding into this need to sort of disclose more and potentially leverage technology to give investors a better understanding of what's behind the numbers. There was a group that had come together about a decade or so ago, put together by the American Assembly, and they did sort of a study on the current state of financial reporting and recognized that so many more of the numbers within the financial statements are estimates based. And they came up with the term, which I absolutely love, because it captures the essence of the issue, that financial reporting represents the brittle illusion of exactitude. Mm-hmm. That we, you know, report an earnings per share number of $3.48. That's the sort of end process consisting of literally hundreds of estimates, and one could have come up with a wide range of reasonable estimates that might have given you different numbers, yet we boil it all down to one amount. And in some respects, that can be misleading. And so part of what I hope we take advantage of with respect to the ability to sort of introduce a more technologically flexible disclosure mechanism is to provide investors greater understanding of the assumptions and the ranges so that sort of they can go in and do their own plug and play and have a sense and a feel for the variability inherent in these numbers, which then is much more useful in terms of predicting ranges of future cash flows. That is also coming.
Well, that's fascinating to me. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of the equity analysts do now is take the, like you said, single numbers that are reported associated with various line items in the income statement, balance sheet, statement of cash flows, and then they take qualitative disclosures and all that they know and convert that to distributional amounts, like a probability density function might even be something for academics, right, that are out there. So do you think at some point in time, since we're on this topic, if you look into the future, will there be a point in time where what you see in the primary financial statements, in the general purpose financial statements, as they are called, instead of these point estimates, that you do see more something more akin to a distribution or ranges. Is that coming?
It makes sense as you think about it. I mean, the $3.84 or whatever, I mean, we don't have any gun that shoots that straight in financial reporting. I mean, the implied precision of that is almost unrealistic. So I do agree with the notion of ranges and estimates, and we've talked about using different types of information to make different kinds of disclosures or reach different types of conclusions, maybe historical cost information for some purposes, current value information for other purposes. Now, we've had this for a long time. We have this great debate about one or the other, but perhaps there is place with the types of information systems that we will have and the evolution of that going into the future for both, and they'll each have their relative place. I think of XBRL is perhaps a starting point for this, but I just can't, from my own standpoint, see what that is doing right now. Maybe it's being used and used effectively to make better judgments about what is being reported in the aggregation process where I am familiar with it. We comply with the requirements. We file the information. I don't know that I've had any, or the companies have had any analysts asking questions based solely on the XBRL disclosures. I just don't know, Joe. It's be interested in what you see and hear. I think it's there. I think it's being complied with. I think it could be part of a process that would lead to better, more complete financial information, but I'm just not familiar with how it's being used.
I view XBRL as step one. I mean, it is probably at this point a decade-old technology, and it has produced some real benefit in terms of taking sort of the manual manipulation process out of a consumer's job, because it immediately allows you to sort of download the flat file, take the numbers and import them into a spreadsheet without having to rekey them. And there's a real benefit of sort of the efficiency that comes with that, as well as eliminating the ability for error in sort of manually rekeying that data. But the ultimate potential of technology is a many multiple magnitude of simply taking a flat file and converting it into electronic format. And we're just sort of scratching the surface. We haven't really leveraged the ability of technology to allow drill down capability in successive layers of information disclosure that can be accessed by individuals on a customized basis. XBRL is probably phase one.
Okay.
Mark, a comment if I could make sure. To the topic that Joe responded to quite well, and I'm not as familiar with the specifics of the SEC project or initiative on disclosure effectiveness. I would only relate it back perhaps to my earlier broad definition of financial reporting and ask what is the focus of the review, and if the answer is the focus of the review is let's look at the 10-K and see what we can do differently in the 10-K, or let's look at the 10-Q and see what we can do differently in the 10-Q, I would argue that's fine, and that's a good thing to do, and let's take out things we don't need, and let's streamline things that we have. I'm all in favor of those things, but let's look at the big financial reporting picture. Let's add in the earnings process on a quarterly basis. Let's add in the earnings releases. Let's add in the business performance information. If you're really focused on disclosure effectiveness, effective for whose purposes? If the answer is effective for the purpose of making investment decisions, and you're only looking at the regulatory filings, you're missing a big, big part and a growing part of the picture. Somebody needs to step back and look at the total disclosure process that provides the information that people use to make investment decisions, and not just focus on the regulatory end product. As I say, all the activity, where the action is, if you will, on a quarterly reporting basis takes place well before the regulatory filings are ever made. And when they are made, my experience is they are not market-moving events. They are confirmation of information that has previously been submitted. And the earnings process, the quarterly earnings release process, gets a high level of attention and scrutiny from management, audit committees, auditors, because it's very important that that be accurate and that it be effective, and the regulatory process comes along later. Same thing with the 10-K. By the time the 10-K arrives, the process for the year has long before been completed. It does need to confirm what has previously been communicated, but if the 10-K is the source of new information, it's not the right place for that information to get to the marketplace, because it's not timely to find out next March that there's something that I need to be concerned about making investment decisions in the fall of the year or even earlier in the year. So it's a question of, if they're really going to tackle disclosure effectiveness, can you only look at a piece of it, and perhaps not the most dynamic piece that needs change?
And if you look at it all in the aggregate, and then you layer in the functionality of current technology, some of what you can do is really exciting. So just take, for example, in the current system, within one disclosure document, the 10-K, if you're an analyst and you're interested in revenue and the company's prospects for generating revenue, there may be some disclosure about revenue in the risk factors section, some disclosure in the business section, some in the MD&A, more yet in the footnotes. And then outside of that 10-K, there's likely some information about revenue within the press release, perhaps a Q&A that touched on revenue prospects on an analyst call, perhaps some revenue information in an 8-K that was filed in connection with a significant event. technology has the potential to take and integrate all those discrete pieces and with one click of a button bring them all together in one place for somebody who's interested in learning about the company's revenue. And the SEC's disclosure database would be the natural housing of all of that information, you know, across the set of public companies that would allow some incredibly powerful analytic tools to be deployed if only we sort of leverage the ability of technology to tag these pieces and then allow them to be sorted and cut and pasted with the click of a button. And I could see that coming.
Yeah, that's exciting because I think that's a huge value proposition to take the enormous growth in unstructured data that is all out there and then structure that for decision makers. You know, I want to go back to one of Mike's earlier points where, as I understand it, what's visible to many stakeholders with respect to the auditor is largely a one-off annual report. But the activity of the auditors occurring, a lot of the activity is occurring way up in the front of the engine, to use your analogy, in the, with management when decisions, key decisions are being made. And what you see today is maybe as a result of some frustration about that, is you see some move afoot in various reporting jurisdictions to actually change the content of the auditor's report. And what you see, for example, in the UK, there are a number of audit reports, probably near 100 or more. Some that have gotten a lot of popular press has been a report from KPMG regarding Rolls-Royce and a report from Deloitte on Vodafone. Those are two examples. And what's happening in these reports is a lot more information content about some of the judgment inputs that the auditors have entertained to help guide their audit. For example, planning and performance materiality. You'll also see them comment on what's very similar to what's being proposed here by the PCAOB, that critical audit matters. You'll see in some of these reports commentary from the auditor about how management resolved these difficult to audit areas. And often you'll see what additional procedures, if any, the auditor did to address those areas. So I guess, is that in part a response to trying to make more of the value that the auditor brings more out into the public arena? And if so, how do you see that evolving, both maybe in the near term, because it is a hot button issue right now, but over the longer term, the nature of the auditor's report? And that's really for either of you, Mike.
Well, I think change in that direction is positive, but I question the value of it. And I question the value of it for the same basic reason that I question about the annual audits and the annual financial statement is timeliness. The PCAOB, and again, I respect the fact that they have limited jurisdiction. They have a limited mandate. But nonetheless, we all who participate in this process need to find a way to improve all of it without limitations of legislative mandate. But on this point, I'm talking about critical audit matters. And they characterize that as, we want auditors to communicate about what was keeping them up at night during the course of the audit. And I say, again, to the timing issue, I'm not really so interested. I'm very interested in what's keeping Joe up at night when he's leading an audit of a major company. But I'm not really interested in hearing next March what kept him up at night in March the year before. I want that information to go where it can be useful on a timely basis. The audit committees are the place for this. They represent the investor community. They represent the shareholders. And I said in my response to the PCAOB on the proposal with respect to the auditor's report, the communication needs to go to the right people at the right time that can do something about it. And it needs to go to the audit committee as part of the audit planning process. And if something's keeping Joe up at night in July, after we did the audit plan back in March or April, and something's really bothering him in July, I want the people who need to know, and that's the audit committee, to know about it in July, not next March. So my issue is, you know, I find the auditor's report to be reasonably effective for what it seeks to accomplish. People kind of disparage the past fail. They're like there's something wrong with that. I don't find anything wrong with that at all. I find it more wrong that we're going to make that harder to discern by putting in 7 or 8 or who knows how many critical audit matters that will cause people to wonder whether the passing grade really was a passing grade or whether somebody should have got a failing grade that didn't get a failing grade. And I don't see that that enhances the investor's understanding of the audit process to say, well, we're giving them a passing grade, but here are 8 things that kept us up at night before we got there. That just doesn't work for me. And I do believe that audit committees have the need and responsibility to get this information, to deal with it, to talk to the auditors. If something's bothering the audit team, hear about it on a timely basis, ask management, get management together with the auditors, and work your way through it. Talk to the right people about the right things at the right time. I don't see that being accomplished by adding a lot more information into the auditor's report. And I think it has all of the downsides that people are concerned about. Again, diminishing the impact of the pass-fail judgment and communicating through the auditor's report things which should be communicated by the management of the company in the first instance.
Yeah, I actually think this directional move towards expanding the auditor's role outside of just a pure pass-fail on the backwards-looking financial statements is at the same time exciting and scary. And if you're a student, you ought to be really excited, and I'll explain why. Let me first address the scary part, though. So I'll take the blame on behalf of my profession that historically, you know, we have tended to be very resistant to significant change. And the reason we've been resistant to significant change, particularly in, you know, what we say to the general public or how we say it, is because of liability risk, the risk of litigation within the U.S. environment. And that's certainly a legitimate concern. But I worry as much from a risk standpoint around sort of the macro trends we've been talking about over the last 40 minutes with respect to the relevance to the investing community of the backwards-looking financial information and the increasing relevance of some of the information that gets reported through the financial reporting system outside of the basic annual and quarterly statements, and that sort of the auditor needs to ensure in order to remain relevant and sort of a valuable part of the capital market system that we're in that financial reporting engine and we're in it in a way that's visible to the investing public. And the fact that in jurisdictions around the world, there's this conversation about how to enhance the amount of work the auditors are doing and what we say to the general public. It ought to give you a level of confidence that sort of this is a vibrant and exciting growth profession where there's tremendous opportunity for students sort of coming into the firms and coming into the corporate community. And all of that is very, very positive. Now, how exactly you do it is difficult. And so, you know, we can debate the merits of particular proposals. Mm. But it's evident to me that there is an expanded role for auditors to be involved with information over and above slapping an opinion one day a year on Groundhog's Day on last year's financial information. So whether that's through these CAMs that you talked about, whether it's through greater association with financial information in the rest of the 10K outside of the financial statements, which is also something that PCOB is thinking about, whether it's through some form of auditor attestation on information that's not within the regulatory filings, but the broader ethos of information that's being reported today and relied upon, we can all sort of have a very good and productive debate. But the mere fact we're having that dialogue and that you're seeing the auditing firms speaking out in support of an expanded role for the auditor is a net positive for the profession.
Okay.
I think that, and Mark, just to add to that thought, I think there is real value to be added, and it is being added, but I'm not sure how widespread or how far down it goes, the auditors being up there in the engine with the timely financial reporting and financial reporting on a broader base than just financial statements, regulatory-based financial statements. But there is, and if this is the information that matters to the marketplace, if this is what investors make decisions on, there is assurance that can and should be provided there that would have high value. And it's not going to be audited on a quarterly basis in the traditional sense of auditing, but auditors are very capable people. They know a great deal about a company. They knew a great deal about financial reporting. They can add assurance, and they will be reluctant to do so, as Joe indicates, but everybody, I think, in time will see if that's the value proposition and that's where this profession really makes a difference for the investing community in the future, they'll get there. And they'll get there in the right way. But auditors can add, you know, levels of assurance with respect to the reasonableness of the information that is presented outside the traditional financial reporting system that they opine on. Consistency is very important. When you talk about non-GAAP measures and people start giving different kinds of information, one of the things that's very important is that that be consistent from period to period, not that in the first quarter we pick one way and adjust our reported results. In the second quarter, that didn't work out so well, so we pick a different way to do it. And year to year, it's not done the same way. If people are going to report business performance information and non-GAAP information, consistency from period to period is very important. We don't have a system that provides that consistency across companies at this point, because what is a business performance indicator for one company in a particular industry might be different from how that has been defined by other companies. Their disclosure becomes important. It becomes very important that if you choose a term like operating cash flow, which is a commonly used term, EBITDA, somewhat the same, but if you are going to use a term like that, you really do need to disclose completely what it is that you have done to define that and what it consists of, because other companies in the same industry as you're in are calling something operating cash flow, and it's not with the same components because there is no standard across industries for those types of disclosures. Auditors can be very helpful in assessing the adequacy of disclosure. They can't be responsible for bridging the gap from company A to company B if there are no standards and people choose to define a metric differently. But they can be sure that the information is there that enables people to say, oh, I see, company A includes X and company B doesn't include X, and I have the information, so if I want to compare company A to company B, I can add it in or take it out, whatever needs to be done. There's value to the independent assurance that can be brought to that information. And if that's where the action is, that's where the value is going to be. And we need to get out of the caboose and get into the engine on a more continuous basis. And I think, to Joe's point, I think also some form of more frequent and continuous communication. I'm not sure having the auditors issuing their review reports on quarterly information is going to add great value. I'd like to hear from them five times a year instead of once a year, just as a matter of course. But those reports could be included today, and there does not seem to be a market demand for that. And yet they are issuing those reports to audit committees on an every quarter basis, and they're very valuable to audit committees to have that assurance.
So that's rather fascinating to me, because you have a value proposition for the auditors to become much more visibly involved with information that's disclosed to the stakeholders, the investors, anyone who's consuming financial reporting in a more public way. And what you're saying, Mike, reminds me of an academic study where they were showing basically that a variety of mutual funds would pick and choose how they calculated returns year over year over different periods and to make, you know, returns look better. So that makes a lot of sense. Let me broaden the topic just a little bit. Do you guys have an opinion about the extent to which financial reporting will be melded with overall business reporting? So what I'm getting at in part is what you see today called CSR being corporate social responsibility reporting, where you see companies saying, not only here's what we're doing in terms of our traditional earnings per share, in terms of operating cash flow, but here's what we're doing to make our society, you know, better. You can think of a green company, you can think of safety information, environmental performance. Is that something that is going to be integrated into financial reporting, or are these things that are more or less fads that will dissipate over the next decade or so?
Well, I'll express a view that they're not at all fads, that they are. This is a very important area. It matters to society, it matters to consumers, it matters ultimately to investors, because how well you do on your social responsibility in the long run can have a considerable effect on the value of your company. So I don't think it's a fad. I think it's here to stay, and I think it will become even more prominent and more frequent as we go forward. My only question is whether it is enhancing either financial reporting or social responsibility reporting to add them together. And we've seen a little bit of this in the recent issues with respect to SEC reporting, SEC disclosure requirements with respect to conflict minerals. And asking, it's an important issue, and it's appropriate to have disclosure about it. But is it a part of the disclosure regime for financial reporting, or is it for a different purpose and should be put in a different place? I'm all in favor of both of these trains going down the track. I'm just not sure adding them together is going to be an enhancement to the overall process. But I don't think social reporting is going to gain any less importance. I think quite the opposite. There are a lot of things going on in our country that are very important to us that are socially oriented and will be part of the disclosure system, I think, going forward.
I absolutely agreed. I mean, to some extent, we've already seen some level of integration taking place, including through groups like the IIRC trying to bring together a model of sort of portraying a balanced scorecard of metrics, both financial and non-financial, that represent value drivers. I think the most fascinating part of this dialogue, though, is sort of where the line is drawn. And so clearly there's a much broader set of metrics that actually speak to issues that are directly relevant and material to investors. And when you meet that threshold, there's little disagreement as to whether the SEC disclosure regime should be used to capture the totality of that information, whether it's financial or non-financial. As long as it has sort of a direct material impact to evaluating the company's prospects through the lens of an investor, where you start to break down in terms of consensus is when there are sort of those who would wish to use the SEC's disclosure system to accomplish other societal goals that don't necessarily materially influence the value of the company to an investor. And there's been some pushback, including some statements coming out of the SEC as to whether that was really the purpose for which the SEC's disclosure system was created. And you'll continue to see that play out in a number of different contexts. The SEC continues to get requests from constituents to require companies to disclose things like corporate political contributions. There are those on the other side who say, interesting, but these are small dollars. And, if somebody believes those should be disclosed, don't knock on the SEC's door. Knock on sort of the door of those who regulate elections. And so that's where the dividing line and the sort of the battleground will be.
Let me ask a more pointed, maybe in some sense shorter term question before I'll end on a little more bigger picture question. And this is another sort of contemporaneous issue. One of the things you see going back to the auditor's report is the idea that somehow by naming an engagement partner on the annual audit, that statutory, compliance oriented general purpose financial statements audit somewhere would be of help, that would help reduce transactions costs, reduce the cost of capital. What is Mike? What are your thoughts on that? And Joe, your thoughts, or where do you think that might be going?
Well, having been part of a significant auditing firm and significant audit engagements over the years, I understand the way an audit of a major company is done, and it is hardly done by any single individual, but. I think if that requirement were to go in place, maybe in addition to getting the lead partner to identify himself and sign up, maybe the CEO of the firm and the head of the audit practice and 10 other partners who work on the engagement ought to be identified as well. But I'm not sure even the basic information is necessary. But I also have a sense this train may have left the station and it's going to happen. And then I would ask my broken record question, if you don't mind, about timeliness. And I really don't know how much informational content there is for me to find out. I'd be delighted to find out Joe was the lead partner on any engagement that I was associated with, but I'm not sure finding it out next March is going to be all that helpful to me. The audit's over. The work for the year is done. I would say if you're going to require this information, and I think people seem to be headed in that direction, why not put it in the proxy statement for the current year when the auditors are being either elected or ratified, when it's important for me to know who the auditor is going to be that's going to do the work during the coming year, not the past year. And that seems to me, and I realize there may be complications in timing of appointments and things of that type, but again, for me, is if we're going to require new information, let's be sure it's coming to people at a time when they can deal with it in the most valuable way.
I agree this train has left the station, and frankly, as an organization that's really in the business of transparency, we're not going to be sort of out arguing against transparency. If people would like this information, the CEOs and the CFOs of companies that produce this information already have their names out there, and we'll certainly produce the name of the lead audit partner based on the most recent public press reports over the last week or so. It looks like they've sort of found a mechanism to accommodate the disclosure of this information within sort of the current regulatory infrastructure. And so I'm sort of looking forward to seeing the proposal that comes out soon.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me just closing question. I'm very interested in both of your views on this. So we sort of recently have begun this look back process for the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And one of the things that's amazing about that piece of legislation is that it really represented a huge change instead of all at once, instead of a little bit of a change at a time. And if we were to think about whoever's sitting in a place like this 20 years from now, and we think about the nature of the changes that you foresee coming down the road, do you think that these changes will need to wait for another punctuated piece of legislation of the type you see in Sarbanes-Oxley? Or do you think it will happen more gradually?
I for one, Mark, I don't know the answer to the question. If it was a choice, if I could vote for one or the other, I would vote for continuous, progressive change rather than burning platform, crisis-driven upheaval. And Sarbanes-Oxley, in my judgment, accomplished what it was intended to accomplish. And the incidence of earnings management, fraudulent financial reporting has definitely gone down and gone down substantially. I just hope we don't sit and wait for another major crisis of that kind before we do what needs to be done to keep the system up to date and keep people doing the right things on a continuous basis. And we've seen that, how hard it is to deal with this massive repair type legislation or regulation, whether it's Sarbanes-Oxley or Dodd-Frank, it's tough. Let's keep getting better incrementally if we can. But is that going to happen? I don't know. We're real good at crisis management. We're not so good at evolutionary change, but I hope it does.
Anything to add, Joe?
I think you'll see a steady pace of evolution without necessarily a big bang. Part of the driving force here, though, will be how does the change come into existence? Is it through what you might call a sort of push model where regulatory requirements come into effect and make everybody do it? Or is it through a pull model where essentially investors are demanding this information and companies that are looking to access sort of external capital feel compelled to produce information that these investors demand in order to drive a lower cost of capital? And I'd like to think that sort of as the benefits of this type of an evolved reporting model become more and more clear, that the pull model will be sufficient without the need for, you know, the regulatory push. I mean, the other thing I'm encouraged by, though, is, you know, as we look at the worldwide regulatory landscape, I do see an overall trajectory towards the top and not a race to the bottom. And when Sarbanes-Oxley was published, there was a real concern that there would be a flight of capital out of the U.S. markets, that the costs would be prohibitive, and that this regulatory overreach would lead companies to not want to raise capital. In fact, what we've seen is a push by other jurisdictions around the world to match these high standards, and in some cases have even implemented their own local standards that go beyond what Sarbanes-Oxley required. And that's encouraging to see the overall trajectory of regimes enacting higher and higher quality disclosure standards versus competing for companies to domicile based on, you know, we're the ones who let you off easiest. And that's a positive long-term trend.
Well, very interesting. Well, time will tell how much punctuated equilibrium or gradual change. And you know, maybe one of the topics we talked about earlier will be a big player in this. One thing that seems to be different this go today as opposed to even 15, 20 years ago is just this technology is just so much more pervasive. And maybe that will lead to a greater influence of the pull model that you're talking about instead of it being pushed from the top. Well, look, Mike and Joe, I am honored, and I thank you for your time today. It was a very informed discussion. Both of you are, you know, very thoughtful and have a point of view that not too many people have. I don't want to embarrass Mike, but I want to thank him personally because he's contributed so much to the academic scene. The Michael Cook Deloitte Doctoral Consortium has been a longstanding highlight of the American Accounting Association, and we're very thankful for that generosity.
Thank you, Mark.
So today's broadcast will be soon available in audio MP3 format in the Virtual Museum and Archive. An edited transcript will be added later. And on behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank Deloitte LLP for its generous support and assistance in making this program possible. Thank you for joining us today. Good afternoon.